Please open your Bibles to Esther chapter 2, verse number 19, and let's pick up our story about how Queen Esther had been placed by God in this position in order to save the Jewish people from annihilation. Now, we know that she became the chief queen of King Xerxes right around December of 480 BC. And Xerxes took off to western Turkey shortly thereafter, during that winter of 480 going into 479 BC, because he intended to expand the empire westward into the Greek homelands. Now, the histories tell us that he pushed forward into that area during the winter following 479 going into 478 BC. And it was an absolute disaster. He lost a whole bunch of ships during some storms when he was trying to cross into the Greek area. Then when he is marching toward the Greek peninsula, he is delayed at the Hot Gates, Thermopylae, the Hot Gates Pass. 300 Spartans were able to delay hundreds of thousands of Persian soldiers, just enough for the Greeks to mount their defense from unified city-states. And when it was all said and done, in 478, Xerxes had to retreat because he had lost almost half of his original fighting force and a huge portion of his materiel. And so in 478, he came back defeated to the capital city of Susa. And you know that that didn't go over well. I have been emphasizing repeatedly on purpose that one of the chief responsibilities of the wife, Vashti to begin with, but then later Esther, was to support the activities of the king, the emperor, and to convince the women in particular, but all the people of the empire, that they needed to send their husbands and their sons and their brothers off to the glory of the empire. And that some of them, of course, would die, but it would be worth it. Well, when half of your people have died, and that number is in the hundreds of thousands, that is not going to bode well for the attitude of the people toward the king. And it is a context like this that you would not be surprised of the next story in the book of Esther. Esther chapter 2, verse number 19. Now, when the virgins were gathered together the second time. Now, what's meant by this is, I think it's a reference to all of these women that had been in the selection process coming together for an anniversary of Esther's selection as the new queen, and perhaps also in connection with the king being back in the country. So it may be, in fact, that we're talking about December of 477 or something like that. 478 or 477. So these virgins are gathered together the second time. Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate because he apparently is some sort of official in the administration. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. So my guess is that she's in her early 20s now, and she is still keeping her Jewishness under her hat, or under her crown, shall we say, because Mordecai warned her of, I believe, the anti-Semitism that was rising inside the kingdom. And so she's keeping all that quiet. Now, verse 21. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Now, I am not a bit surprised that two of his inside secret service guys or guardians, bodyguards, there at the gate would be so angry at the loss of so many people, perhaps some of their own relatives, maybe brothers or fathers or sons of theirs. Probably not sons because they're eunuchs, but relatives of theirs, companions of theirs, had died in the recent attempt to invade Greece, that they wanted Xerxes dead. It's his fault. He's the one that did it. Now, in the book of Daniel, you may remember that the prophecy was there would be a Persian king that would end up stirring up the Greeks. And so these guys are probably understanding you can't poke a hornet's nest and expect the hornets not to pour out on top of you. And so Xerxes has poked the hornet's nest of Greece, and it's not just that they lost a whole bunch of people recently. There's going to be more battles. The Greeks are going to have reprisal invasions against the empire, and even more people will die. And it's all Xerxes' fault. So these two guys want Xerxes dead. And this, verse 22, came to the knowledge of Mordecai. So he somehow became aware of this assassination plot. And so he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. So it's passed on into the royal household. And when the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. Now we have to correct our mental image here because we, particularly Americans, we in the West, when we hear the word gallows, we think of a hangman's noose on a wooden structure. That's not what you should think about. This is the precursor of crucifixion, where to begin with, it was dead bodies of those that had been executed for crimes were then somehow attached to a pole in order to have their body displayed as a warning to anyone thinking about engaging in the same behavior. So think of the body being impaled or nailed to a pole that's in a public place. So these two assassins are publicly executed and their bodies prominently displayed because of their plot. Now, pay attention to this because it becomes important in the story later. It was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Now, what was recorded? That the information which led to the uncovering of this plot started with Mordecai. What we know is that for whatever reason, Mordecai was not rewarded at this time for providing that information. His name was entered into the record, but he was not thanked in any official capacity for what he did. Chapter number 3. After these things, so now we are probably somewhere in the later 470s. I estimate this at somewhere around 475 BC. So a few years after the disastrous invasion. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedata, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. Now this guy is probably a, quote, war hero, end quote, from the recent invasion. He remained loyal to Xerxes throughout all of that, and so he ends up being made one of the top generals and advisors in the empire. Now, who he is very important. He is an Agagite. And that seems to tie us back into King Agag back in the time of King Saul. Agag was an Amalekite. And the Amalekites had started out as absolute enemies of the Jewish people. When the Jewish people first came out of Egypt, the Amalekites tried to attack and enslave them and got beat off. Then there were fights against the Jewish people from there on out, the Israeli people. God even put a curse on the Amalekites, saying that they would eventually be blotted out because of their status as enemies of God's people, of the Israelis. King Saul was told to carry out that execution of the Amalekite people, to annihilate them. And he failed to do so. In fact, he kept Agag the king alive. And God, in a very public way, had Samuel chew Saul out and then hack King Agag to death in front of everybody. But it is safe to say that one of his descendants carried on the hatred toward the Jewish people, and it became even stronger after his father was killed. And David tried to annihilate the Amalekites and didn't get it done either. Until now, we come here to this point hundreds of years later. And one of those Amalekites has become a chief military leader in the Persian Empire. And he has brought with him this perennial inherited hatred of the Jewish people. You know, I've been talking about how Mordecai was aware of this rise of anti-Semitism within the Persian Empire. I think it was part of this guy's already activities that was promoting that. And so now that he is in charge, there is a bigger problem. Now, verse 2 says, all the king's servants who were at the king's house, king's gate, bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. So he is supposed to be treated as royalty, as the king himself. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. And the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? And when they spoke to him day after day and he would not listen to them, they told Haman in order to see what Mordecai's words would stand, for he was told, he had told them that he was a Jew. Now this gets to the idea that the Jewish people were of the mindset that you did not give this extreme obeisance to anyone but God himself. And what do I mean by extreme? I mean by bowing down before the king as if he is a god. Because that's what a lot of people in the Middle East did. They treated their kings as gods. But Jewish people, people of the promise, knew that there was only one God that they owed that sort of fealty to, that sort of allegiance to. And therefore, Jewish people were not in the habit of getting down on their faces and laying out prone in front of a king and treating him as if he were a god. And so when Mordecai was ordered, or here's the order, that the way that he responds to the king is the way he's supposed to treat this new guy, Haman, he refuses to do so. If he doesn't do that with Xerxes, why would he do it with Mordecai? Or excuse me, with Haman. And so, when Haman is told about this and finds out that he's Jewish, that really triggers him. Verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. He is incensed. He is burning up on the inside. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So he hatches this plot in his head. I will get vengeance, not just simply for myself against Mordecai the Jew. I will get vengeance for myself and my people going all the way back in history against all Jews. I will work to have them annihilated. And so here we see that Nazi attitude of the final solution. Jews are the problem in the world, and I will work to get rid of that problem by killing all the Jews. Now, how's he going to do it? Well, that's the next thing that he works on. Verse number 7, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. So now we have some very clear dating. So this puts us on the very beginning of April of 474 BC. So at that date, the beginning of the year, it's New Year, the spring New Year, they cast the pur, that is, they cast lots before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So on New Year's Day, Haman brings his advisors in, and it's not just simply political advisors, military advisors. He's looking for spiritual advice here. He's actually trying to tap into the spirit world. Casting of lots is expressed in Jewish scripture as this: the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision belongs to the Lord. So the Jewish people use the divine lot to decide things from God's perspective, like who gets which piece of land, or if all things are equal, which person should we choose for this responsibility, like serving in the temple, for example. Well, there was an equivalent to that in the pagan religions as well. So he is trying to ask the spirit world, his gods and goddesses, which day should I set aside to annihilate the Jewish people? And so they go through the months of the year, and the 12th month is selected. And then they go through the days of that month, and they select which day of the month they're to take the Jews out. And so he believes that he now has a divinely selected day for his final solution. And yes, I'm using that language on purpose. Haman is the original Nazi. He is Hitler in the Old Testament. So, verse 8. Now he has to put this into practice. Haman said to King Ahasuerus. So he has the right for private audiences with Xerxes. So he goes in and he says, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Being very vague here, there's this particular group that I want to talk to you about that's a problem. Their laws are different from those of every other people. So they're weird. They're out of step with everybody else. They do not keep the king's laws, which the Jewish people in history, we've seen this, are very often given an exception to the rules that are enforced for everybody else. Using a good example of this that we know historically. The Roman government excused Jewish people from having to work or appear in court or do military service on the seventh day of each week, because it was understood that Jewish people's religion required them not to engage in regular activity on that day. So because Julius Caesar first, and then later Caesar Augustus and others had good relationships with Jewish people, they made that a law. And it wasn't just that. They also excused Jewish people from paying taxes in a sabbatical year, because it was understood that Jewish people did not do a work year in that year. So they didn't bring income that year. So they were excused from paying an income tax. So something similar was probably true with the Persian Empire, that the Jewish people were excused from certain things. I would think that Mordecai and other Jews not bowing in front of Xerxes was chalked up to the idea that Jewish people were excused from showing that sort of obeisance because of their religion. So he is zeroing in on this idea that you got this bunch of people, they're different from everybody else, they don't keep the king's laws, and so, continuing in the verse, that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. They are so out of step with everybody else in the kingdom, we just need to get rid of them. Verse number 9, if it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, executed, annihilated, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver. Now, this is back in the time when precious metals were weighed for their value. So each talent here is 75 pounds or thereabouts. But the buying power is the more significant thing here. We are talking about 6 million days wages that's being described here. So millions upon millions of dollars is what he's offering to the king in order to just get rid of these guys. He basically says, if you let me take care of this, I promise you I can bring millions of dollars into the coffers of the king by getting rid of them. Into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it in the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And we need to be booing and hissing this guy whenever we think about him. So Xerxes is a weak king. He is broken because of his failed invasion of the Greek homelands at this point. He is allowing other people to make decisions on his behalf, and he's allowing money, wealth, the replenishment of the funds take precedence over people's lives. And so let's not let him get off the hook here. So he just hands over his signet ring for this enemy of the Jews to do whatever he wants, which in this case is to annihilate. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as seems good to you. And so then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors all over the provinces, to the officials and all the peoples, to every province in every its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. So now the final solution is official in the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be broken. The Jewish people have less than a year until they are annihilated.